In November 1938, Stalin's family life really ended. When Pavel Aliluyev, Nadia's brother, returned from holiday in Sochi, he found that most of his department had been arrested. According to Svetlana, he attempted to save certain people, trying to get hold of my father, but it was no use. That afternoon, Zhenya was called. "What did you give your husband to eat? He's feeling sick." Zhenya wanted to rush over, but they stopped her. Pavel was sent to the Krimlovka clinic. In the words of the official medical report, when he was admitted, he was unconscious, cyanotic, and apparently dying. The patient did not recover consciousness. So died the brother who had given Nadia her pistol. Zhenya was later accused of murdering Pavel. As Stalin sometimes accused others of his own crimes, we will never know the truth. Beria expanded the terror to include anyone connected to Yezhov, who had once requested Stalin's brother-in-law, Stanislav Redens, to be his deputy. This was the kiss of death. At Kuntsevo, Vasily Stalin heard Beria demand to arrest Redens. "But I trust Redens," replied Stalin, "very decisively." To Vasily's surprise, Malenkov supported Beria. This was the beginning of the alliance between these two, who would not have pressed for the arrest without knowing Stalin's instincts. Redens had the misfortune to be in two or three overlapping circles of suspicion. Beria is always blamed for turning Stalin against his other brother-in-law, but there was more to it than that. Stalin had removed Redens from the Ukraine in 1932. He was close to Yezhov, and he was a Pole. Stalin listened to Beria and Malenkov, and then said, "In that case, sort it out at the Central Committee." Redens was arrested on his way to work, and was never seen again. Anna Redens started phoning Stalin, but was not put through. She appealed to everyone until finally Stalin took her call. He summoned her to the little corner, promising, "We shall make an inquiry about all this." But he made one condition. Nadia's father, Sergei, should come too. Sergei, who had now lost two children, backed out. Beria either threatened him, or perhaps Sergei thought Redens was guilty of something in his unsavory work at the Lubyanka. His wife Olga went instead, a brave but foolish move, since Stalin loathed interfering women. "Why have you come? No one called you," he snarled at her. Anna shouted at Stalin, who had her removed. Stan Redens and the Svanitsas were in jail. Pavel Aliluyev dead. Anna Redens and Zhenya Aliluyeva were banned from the Kremlin. Stalin had allowed the terror to ravage his own circle. When a Bulgarian communist appealed for some arrested comrades, Stalin shrugged, "What can I do for them? All my own relatives are in prison too." This is a revealing excuse. Perhaps Stalin was settling private scores, but he did not regard the terror as a private spree. He was cleansing his encircled country of spies to safeguard his vast achievements before war broke out. His family were among the casualties. He was asserting his own separation from private ties. His vendettas were those of the party because, as he told Vasily, "I'm not Stalin. Stalin is Soviet power." But they also provided a living excuse for demanding that his comrades sacrifice their own families. Nonetheless, he could have saved anyone he wanted, and he did not. Svetlana lost another part of her support system. Karolina Till, the dependable housekeeper, that cozy link to her mother, was sacked in a purge of Germans. Beria found her replacement in a niece of his wife, Alexandra Nakashidze. Tall, slim, long-legged, with perfect pale skin and long, thick, blue-black hair, whom Svetlana resented. Nakashidze's arrival shows Beria's special role in the family. Could she be his spy in Stalin's household that was otherwise controlled by Vlasik? We know that the court encouraged Stalin to remarry. Was she there for Stalin? But Stalin looked elsewhere for his housekeeper. A young maid named Valentina Vasilievna Istomina had worked at Zubalova since the early 30s. In 1938, she came to work at Kuntsevo. Stalin was attracted to a specific ideal, the busty, blue-eyed, big-haired and retroussé-nosed Russian peasant woman, submissive and practical, a baba, who could make a home without in any way becoming involved in his other life. Gradually, Valentina Istomina, known as Valichka, became the mainstay of Stalin's home life. "She laughed all the time, and we really liked her," said Svetlana. "She was very young, with pink cheeks, and she was liked by everyone. She was a pleasant figure, typically Russian." She was Stalin's ideal woman. She served at table deftly, never joined in the conversation, yet she was always there when needed. Valichka was promoted to housekeeper, taking care of Stalin's clothes, the food, the house, and so on, and she travelled with him wherever he went. She was a comfortable soul to be quiet with, yet he trusted her and she was devoted to him. Stalin was farcically proud of the way she prepared his underwear. After the war, one Georgian official was amazed when Stalin showed off the piles of gleaming white smalls in his wardrobe, surely a unique moment in the history of dictators. At the end of the 30s, Valichka became Stalin's trusted companion, and effectively his secret wife, in a culture when most Bolshevik couples were not formally married. "Valya looked after father's creature comforts," Svetlana said. The court understood that she was his companion, and no more was said about it. Valichka appeared like a jolly, quiet, and buxom hospital sister, always wearing a white apron at Stalin's dinners. No one noticed when she attended Yalta and Potsdam. This was as Stalin wished it. Henceforth, Stalin's private life was frozen in about 1939. The dramas of Nadia and Zhenya that had caused him pain and anger were over. He sometimes asked Valichka's political opinions as an ordinary person. Nonetheless, for this political man, she was no companion. He remained lonely. Between the 24th of February and the 16th of March 1939, Beria presided over the executions of 413 important prisoners, including Marshal Yegorov, and three ex-Politburo members. He was already living in the dacha of one of them. Now he suggested to Stalin that they call a halt, or there would be no one left to arrest. The next day, Stalin reflected to Malenkov, "I think we're well and truly rid of the opposition millstone. We need new forces, new people." Blaming all excesses on Yezhov, Stalin protected his other grotesques. Stalin had not forgotten his greatest enemy, Trotsky. Beria and one of the talented specialists in quiet and quick death, Pavel Sudoplatov, were received in the little corner where, pacing silently in soft Georgian boots, Stalin laconically ordered Trotsky should be eliminated within a year. On the 10th of March 1939, the 1,900 delegates of the 18th Congress gathered to declare the end of a slaughter that had been a success, if slightly marred, by Yezhov's manic excesses. The survivors, from Molotov to Zhdanov, remained at the top, but were challenged by the younger generation. Khrushchev joined the Politburo, Barberia was elected candidate, and Malenkov became a CC secretary. This leadership ruled the country for the next decade without a single casualty. Contrary to his myth, Stalin could be surprisingly loyal to his protégés, but not to the BlackBerry. Yezhov was on ice, yet he still attended the Politburo, sat next to Stalin at the Bolshoi, and turned up for work at water transport, where he sat through meetings throwing paper darts. He attended Congress evening sessions, trying to get permission to speak. At the meeting of party elders where the names for the new CC were selected, Stalin called Yezhov forward. "Well, what do you think of yourself? Are you capable of being a member of the Central Committee?" Yezhov protested his devotion. He could not imagine what he had done wrong. Since all the other murderers were being promoted, his bafflement is understandable. "Is that so?" Stalin started mentioning enemies close to Yezhov. "Yosef Vissarionovich," Yezhov cried out. "You know it was I myself who disclosed their conspiracy." "Yes, yes, yes. When you felt you were about to be caught, then you came in a hurry. But what about before that? Did you want to kill Stalin?" "Do you think I don't see anything? Do you remember who you sent on a certain date for duty with Stalin, with revolvers? Why revolvers near Stalin? Well, go on. Get out of here. I don't know, comrades. Is it possible to keep him as a member of the Central Committee? I doubt it. Of course, think about it as you wish, but I doubt it. On the 10th of April, Stalin ordered Yezhov to attend a meeting to hear further accusations. Yezhov reported to Malenkov, who ritualistically removed Yezhov's photograph from the array of leadership icons on his office wall, like an angel removed from the heavens. Beria and his Georgian prince executioner, Tsereteli, opened the door and arrested Blackberry, conveying him to Sukhanov prison. The search of Yezhov's apartment revealed bottles of vodka, 115 counter-revolutionary books, guns, and those most macabre relics, the flattened bullets labelled Zinoviev and Kamenev. More importantly, the search revealed that Yezhov had collected materials about Stalin's pre-1917 police record. Was this evidence that he was an Okhrana spy? There was also evidence against Malenkov. The papers disappeared into Beria's safe.